KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Coming up this hour on Weekday, a conversation with David Stockman, the former Reagan OMB director, talks about the collapsing of the American economy. He blames the Fed, among other culprits. We're also going to take a roundtable look at what happened with media coverage during the Boston Marathon bombings, what's working and what's not working about the crowdsourcing and Twitterizing of information. But we start with what's happening in Olympia. Jerry Kornfield is a columnist and reporter for the Herald in Everett. He joins us to talk about this week in Olympia, which I think will have a theme for maybe longer than expected. Hello, Jerry.
Good morning.
It's good to talk to you again. I was reading your very excellent column about what is happening, what might be happening in Olympia. And one of the things you point out is that even old rookie Jay Inslee might have got ahead of himself by thinking there might be a special session.
Yeah, it's sometimes you. I was thinking it was either truth or gaffe. It came out like it was a gaffe when he was talking about his proposal for a drunken driving bill, and he said it would take several thousands of conversations over the next several weeks. And I quickly reminded him that there was only like 2 weeks left in the session, and he tried to pass that off. But I think in reality, he recognized that the House and Senate are pretty far apart, and it's going to take nothing shy of a miracle to get them on the same page and willing to finish up all their work by midnight this Sunday.
Well, I want to start with a question that you, with a bill that you sent me, and a question about education funding, if I may, since we have been following this all along. And if you'll indulge me, the House Bill 2038, investing in the Education Legacy Trust for K through 12 basic education and higher education by narrowing or eliminating tax preferences and extending taxes set to expire. I will cherry pick a few of these. Permanently extends the 0.3% business and occupation B&O surtax on service businesses, eliminates the preferential B&O tax rate for insurance agents, eliminates the tax rate for travel agents, repeals the sales tax exemption for bottled water, repeals the non-resident sales and use tax for tangible personal property, modifies and extends the beer tax, imposes sales and use tax on janitorial services. It goes on. There are many specifics here. Jay Inslee has talked about them. The House Democrats have talked about these tax breaks and tax loopholes and exclusions. What's going to happen with this?
Well, it's really hard to predict where they're going to end up. It's going to be something less than that long list that you were reading. Tomorrow morning, the House Finance Committee will be meeting, and the theory is they will, you know, push forward a bill that will have some of those pieces in it, the ones they think they have enough votes to pass in the House and maybe enough votes to pass in the Senate. You know, there's a couple of items out there to raise about $300 million. They deal with making some changes in law in response to some Supreme Court decisions, and they deal with telecommunications and the estate tax. But everything you went through, they're new. They're changes that have been talked about. For example, bottled water. A couple of years ago, it was proposed to start putting a sales tax on bottled water, and the voters rejected that. So they may try again. I think there's a couple in there that will add up. They'll be passed, and folks will agree that we can do it. But they won't raise, it'll never raise the $1 billion that they're heading toward. I don't think they can get to that far.
Meaning what in terms of the people who are lobbying for increased education funding?
Well, I think what it means is the expectations for $1 billion may be met. There may be $1 billion more spent on education in the next 2 years on top of what's been spent, but then that means they'll have to give up something else. Clearly, there'll be some areas of education, like teacher pay increases, that'll be suspended, and there's savings of $300 million. There'll probably be some cuts or no increases in funding in some human service and social service programs that are coming along. So I think that the trade-off is going to be less expansion of social service programs, probably some changes also in the education, policy making. There may be some laws passed that will make it easier for principals to assign teachers to their schools or for schools to be graded on an A to F scale. Things that Democrats in the House have kind of pushed back against and opposed, they may have to relent if they want to get new revenue.
It sounds from your interpretation that the Senate Republicans and the Democrats who created that majority are going to chalk this up to a win on their side.
Well, they're going to both try to come out with a win, and then they're going to all try to say it was a compromise. I mean, in the end, I don't think that there's a disagreement. I mean, let me back up. The Republicans in the Senate and some and the two Democrats that broke away to join them will say, we don't need any more dollars coming into the state to pay for education. The problem is it's not education alone that costs more money. They're passing laws or talking about passing laws that are going to put more people behind bars. So that means it costs more for Department of Corrections. And so you can't just freeze spending on all areas of government while increasing in education. And that's why the Democrats are saying we need more money for schools so that we don't have to cut back in other parts of government. In the end, they're going to have to find a middle ground. There's going to be some limits on how far government grows in some areas in order to increase funding for schools. I didn't think they could get to the $1 billion mark. When they started this session, I thought they might be able to add $500 to $600 million more in basic education funding. So if they can get to $1 billion, I think that'll be quite an accomplishment.
You mentioned that that rather than in being engaged in a negotiation, the Republicans and the Democrats are engaged in a stare down, at least last week. Is that continuing this week?
It's so far. I mean, this stare down is, the Republicans have said, okay, Democrats, you say you want to raise money. Prove to us that you can pass a bill that raises money. And so the House Democrats last week passed what for them were the easy ones. They were the responses to Supreme Court decisions on telecommunications and the estate tax. Now comes the tough part. Tomorrow, this House Finance Committee will have to decide on the large list of tax preferences and tax bills and changes and so forth. So we'll find out. For example, I don't think the House Finance Committee is going to push forward on increasing the tax on every barrel of microbrewed beer. They got a pretty good little lobby, and they got a lot of fans in the legislature. So microbrewers probably will be able to repel the proposal to tax them more than they're already being taxed. So some changes aren't going to happen. Meanwhile, the House Democrats have looked over at the Republicans and said, you have some policies in your budget that cut social service programs, but you haven't passed those policies, so maybe you don't really want to cut social service programs. So they're staring at them saying, you passed the policies, and prove to us that you can do that. And so neither side has taken the really tough votes at this stage, and I think that's what we're going to have to see happen in the next 3 or 4 days, or they're just going to have to agree to find a middle ground.
You were looking at the governor's and the legislature's proposals for changing the drunk driving laws. The governor got into some trouble in answering the question because it's a long bill. It's a big proposal. Are the legislators going to take it up quickly?
Well, they're taking it up quickly in terms of they're holding hearings. Tomorrow morning, one Senate committee wants to do a work session. A House committee wants to actually vote their bill out of committee. So they're showing signs that they want to move quickly, but it is a really comprehensive bill. There are a lot of problems with some of the wording, and there are just a lot of issues with some of the policy. In their hearing last week, there was 4 hours of hearing, and there was plenty of people with criticism saying we should change this, you need to change that, this part might be unconstitutional. If a bill does emerge this session, it's going to be slimmed down quite a bit. It may increase some punishment for those who are repeat offenders, say on their third or fourth offense, and it should increase treatment programs for those who have been repeatedly arrested for drunken driving. But it's not going to go as far as the governor wants.
Transportation. They're supposed to come up with a transportation package here. Democrats had a proposal. They want to raise money. They want to see gas taxes and car tabs. And they want to include that bridge over the Columbia River. Do they have support from Republicans on the revenue side?
Well, we'll find out probably this morning. The House Transportation Committee at this hour is discussing that proposal. There's a lot of amendments to it, so they're going through those, and soon they'll vote on the revenue bill. And when it comes out of the committee, we'll see if it's going to be straight Democrats for and Republicans against, or if they'll be able to pick up some Republican support. That'll be a good sign of whether or not it can move through the House and over to the Senate and be done this week. I mean, part of the problem, and I think in the back of people's minds, is there's going to be a special session, that they won't be done by Sunday. So there may be a sense of, not a sense of urgency, because they feel that, if we go to special session, we get up to 30 more days to work all this out. And I think that that's maybe weighing in people's minds.
You know, the lobbying sounds like it's been pretty powerful this session. We saw it with gun control. We're seeing it with these the people protecting their various tax breaks and tax loopholes and expansions or retractions. What does it look like to you, somebody who's been there a long time? More or less?
Well, it looks to me, inside the Capitol, it looks sort of the same people doing the same lobbying for the same organization. So in terms of the bodies, it looks the same. But there is a whole other element of lobbying outside, both in the communities and by the Internet. And so that has picked up quite a bit. Organizations are using the Internet, whether it's through social media or just from organizing email campaigns, and that has picked up. I have to say Brad Shannon of the Olympian today, he had tabulated how much the interest groups and public agencies had reported spending on lobbying just through March, and he came up with $12.9 million. That's just essentially, most of that is January, February, March, some of it last year. So they're spending quite a bit of money, but they're also, it's the same fights that have been going on over the last few years.
Well, all right. It's a mort la plus chance. Huh? I mean,
it shouldn't be surprising that when you have the tax measures on, that there's so much lobbying. I mean, one of the things with this tax bill is it covers so many areas that one lobbyist can go in and represent multiple industries on multiple measures. So one body can speak for quite a few industries, and you can bet they're all here. I mean, the professional services and the refiners and the even the pro-bike, the bike riders were organized enough to knock a fee out of the transportation revenue before it even got included. There was going to be a fee on new bike sales, and that fell out. So folks are working it all different ways.
Yeah. Well, I thought education was going to be a big deal this session. What do I know?
It will. In the end, that will be where you will see the governor and the leaders of the House and Senate stand side, shoulder to shoulder, talking about what they've done for education from preschool to college, and they will claim victory. And I think the public as a whole will find that they did succeed on that. But it's going to take a few more days, maybe a few more weeks to get there.
All right, sir. I appreciate your perspective. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Jerry Kornfield is a reporter, a columnist for the Everett Herald, covering the state legislature. This is Weekday.
Ten 18. Former federal budget director David Stockman talks about the corruption of capitalism in America in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Women's Therapy Referral Service. For over 35 years, helping people find the right therapist through personalized matching and in-person consultation. Details online at therapyreferral.org.
50 degrees in Seattle under a clear blue sky. Forecast calls for sun all day and a high of 60. Then clear overnight, more sun tomorrow, Tuesday, with a high of 64. 10:19, I'm Bernard Ouellette. When news unfolds quickly, as it did last week in the Boston bombing case, a lot of rumors start flying around, and reporting can get pretty sketchy. So how do you know what to believe anymore? We'll take that up in 20 minutes.
Taking the American economy to the woodshed. On KUOW Seattle, I'm Steve Scher. Back in 1985, Federal Budget Director David Stockman was sharply rebuked by his boss, Ronald Reagan, for saying the president's tax programs were trickle-down, designed to help the rich. These days, author David Stockman is taking Ben Bernanke, Wall Street banks, and the Obama administration to the woodshed for printing money, running deficits, helping Wall Street banks survive, and leaving the gold standard. David Stockman calls this the Great Deformation.
It basically says our fundamental institutions, capitalism, free market capitalism, and political democracy are failing. They have been corrupted by a hybrid form of capitalism that is dominated by the political process and by money power and the influence of lobbies, both on the Washington process and on the Federal Reserve and in the what I call the Wall Street casino. So we end up with the worst of both. Our government does not represent the people anymore, and the financial market is basically a gambling arena that does not raise capital to support long-term growth and investment in our economy. So that's crony capitalism. And it is a corruption of both democracy and the free market.
So deformed from what, though?
Deformed from their fundamentally valid idea. Free markets are a good way to grow an economy, to raise living standards, to have technological progress, achieve long-term economic health. When they're corrupted by crony capitalism, they begin to fail, and ultimately they fail badly. Political democracy has to have basically citizen influence and not merely organized squeaky wheels and money and PACs and K Street lobbies and so forth. We've now reached the point that political democracy doesn't work anymore. We have two parties that are essentially what I call glorified concierges. They introduce their politicians to money and to the machinery of reelection, but they don't stand for anything, and they'll compromise whenever and as and however necessary in order to reelect their incumbents. And so that's another feature or aspect of how broken this system is.
David Stockman is author of The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. Okay, that's the big picture. That's your two-minute soundbite comment. But when you're talking about a free market, you are hearkening back to a classical notion of the free market. So what is the notion you're hearkening back to?
Well, the notion that supply and demand determines the outcome, the notion that there are winners and losers, and the marketplace will determine whether you're a winner or loser. I say too big to fail is a modern perversion of the fundamental notion of market capitalism, which we had for a century in this country. And it started when we bailed out continental Illinois in 1984, but it really got bad when Rubin was in the Clinton White House and they bailed out the Wall Street banks in 1994 because of the Mexican peso crisis. They loaned way too much money to Mexico. And then it became embedded in 1998 when we had the long-term capital crisis and the Greenspan Fed organized Wall Street to bail out what was essentially a rogue hedge fund, out of control, levered 100-to-1 gambling house that should have gone down. Once that happened, Wall Street got the idea that the Fed would always be there to rescue the downside, to put a floor under the market. What was called the Greenspan put got invented then, and it fundamentally distorted financial markets. It caused an enormous amount of reckless gambling behavior to occur because the gamblers felt the Fed had their back. And that led to the housing bust and all the other things we're dealing with today, including the third bubble that we're having at this moment. And the doctrine that they're too big to fail, they're too big to jail, they're too big to regulate. And that tells me that we have an enormous threat still right in the center of our financial system.
All right. But fundamentally, when you're talking about a free market, you are arguing the least regulation possible or no regulation?
I'm arguing in most spheres, the less regulation the better, including like in trucking or transportation or agriculture or car making or steel industry or computers, etc. There is one exception, which is really important. banks need to be regulated, and it was a mistake to repeal Glass-Steagall. The reason banks need to be regulated and strictly regulated is they are not really free enterprises. They are wards of the state. And by that I mean banks have deposit insurance, which makes it very easy to raise deposits because depositors don't care. The government guarantees through FDIC. The banks have access to the so-called cheap money, free money window of the Federal Reserve. So if they get in over their skis, they can always go and bail out their balance sheet.
But why should the banks have that that particular guarantee from the FDIC? Why should we have that?
Well, I don't think we should have it. I think deposit insurance, which came out of the New Deal, is actually a bargain with the devil, so to speak, because it does make people feel more secure about their savings if they're an average person. On the other hand, it allows banks to gamble with money that's backed up by the taxpayers. So we need to go back to strict regulation of narrow banks and tell the traders, okay, the Goldman Sachs of the world, you don't get the Fed window. You don't get to use deposit insurance. If you want to be swinging for the fences, you want to be leveraged 25 to 1, whatever they are leveraged at the moment, fine. But if you fail, there's no Fed to bail you out, and there's no deposit insurance to help you raise money.
But your argument is also about the fundamental relationship between markets and a government.
Right.
And when you are looking at, for example, a market, don't markets exist down through history because of the way we have organized ourselves, which includes the government? Doesn't the government, even when it was feudal government, guarantee this person is going to make this trade, and you have the guarantee of my club in feudal times that we won't have problems? I mean, isn't that what government does with markets? It actually helps them become free?
Well, in the sense of contract law and having a legal system to enforce the contractual rights that you and I mutually undertake when we do a trade or an investment, yes, that is the role of government. But in that role, the government is a neutral referee. That's not the same thing as having 10 bankers go to the third floor of the Treasury on the summons of Paulson, Hank Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury in a Republican administration, and say, each of you are getting $10 billion. Here it is, because I'm worried that if any more banks fail or investment banks fail in Wall Street, the economy is going to come unwound. And that is that isn't a referee. That is basically putting the taxpayers in harm's way.
But you're making the connection all the way back to, as you said, when we left the gold standard and then when we entered into the New Deal, that what happened in the New Deal is a antecedent to what Hank Paulson did. The argument other people are making is that what happened in the New Deal was rescuing a failed system that wasn't regulated enough.
Yes, but, you know, I think there's so much mythology about the New Deal that it's a whole discussion in itself, and it's why I have a couple of chapters. But first, the institutions.
You have 800 pages.
Yeah, but I have a few chapters on the New Deal. But some of the bad institutions that came out of the New Deal, for instance, are Fannie Mae. That was created by the New Deal. They thought it was a little way to help the middle class access the mortgage market better, and it ended up being a $5 trillion monster after the crony capitalist evolution and deformation of 4 or 5 decades took it to, you know, where we all know it was in 2007.
But is that inevitable? Are you saying that inevitable deformation happens because greed follows money to corrupt?
I say the danger of accounting, of relying too much on the state, is the state then becomes captured by crony capitalists, by the squeakiest wheels and the biggest money, and it leads to a perversion. The people in the Roosevelt administration who put in Fannie Mae never expected it would be the kind of financial monster that it turned out to be in the late 1990s and early 2000, or that it would lure, you know, millions of American households into mortgages that were predatory and they shouldn't have had and they couldn't cope with afterwards. So that is only one example, but deposit insurance did the same thing.
But where do you point to a government or a small government where the kind of capitalism, the kind of free market you write about in this book and your and your book writing about. Where does it exist?
Well, it existed for most of history in the United States, and not even after the New Deal. I didn't say we, you know, went down the slippery slope in 1 year. The Great Depression was really the aftermath of World War I. The whole world bankrupted itself in World War I. It wrecked its monetary systems. Everybody printed currency like crazy in order to pay the bills to fight a stupid war that never should have happened. Anyway, they tried to correct that in the 20s. It failed. It led to a world depression that was essentially the consequence of the destruction of World War I. And therefore, you needed to address that in ways that are unrelated to where we are in 2008 when our crisis came, or 2013 today.
You would not say, though, that we had better depressions or recessions back in the 1880s and 1890s than we have had since, right? They were long drawn out downturns in the economy.
That's what the Keynesians tell you, and it's not true.
We had better, they were shorter and not
yes,
as painful?
There were six basic so-called banking panics from 1870 to 1914 when the Fed was created. The scholarship shows that three of them didn't even get out of Wall Street. They were just panics in the stock market, in the gambling arena, Wall Street. They never flowed out to Ohio or Nebraska or the rest of the country. The other two...
So the scholars that disagree with you on that are wrong?
I mean, there are scholars that basically have studied all this and show, including the number one scholar of the 19th century economic performance, Christina Romer, who was Obama's chief economic advisor, demonstrated that in the period from 1869 to 1912, 43 years, the economy grew at nearly 4% a year. Industrial production rose by like 600%. The standard of living of the average worker and farmer in America went up enormously, never before, never again replicated over a 43-year period.
Would she make that was a connection to the structure of an unregulated and gold-dependent or gold-standardized economy?
She was an economist who studied the results.
Isn't she a Keynesian, too?
Yeah, she's a total Keynesian. So I'm only saying my data is based on her scholarship and the scholarship of a lot of other people.
But you're not just cherry-picking her data to make...
Here, take this one, just very quickly. In 1870, when the Civil War ended, there were 40 million people in America. Over the next 40 years that we're talking about here, 27 million people immigrated here. Now, they didn't come here because it was a dystopia. They didn't come here because there was a crisis every other year and there were depressions forever and deflation and so forth. They came here because the economic opportunities were enormous, and that is the better, ultimate proof than anything some economists will come up with.
And that was contingent upon an economy that was unregulated.
Well, it wasn't just unregulated, but that was an important part of it. But also, we did not have a Federal Reserve. We did not have a Wall Street that controlled the printing press of our country. During that period, we had balanced budgets for 40 years. It couldn't have been all that bad, or how did you get all that economic growth?
I mean, you're also talking about an era when the progressives and the progressive state emerged because of the working conditions of the very people you're talking about. So a government regulatory system started to emerge just then in response to that capitalism.
Yeah, well, you know, when we talk about regulation, public safety and health regulation, I'm not objecting to. That's not what we're talking about here. The kind of intervention that I'm objecting to is when we bail out failing companies, when we bail out General Motors and thereby move jobs from Georgia, where they would have worked for Hyundai to make cars, to Michigan, where they would work for the UAW. That's what I object to.
So let's stick with that. You would have done what with the car industry?
I would have let General Motors fail because it had been ruined by management in Detroit over decades.
How would that have affected the 2 million workers that were discussed in that area that were not just in GM and the other car companies, but the ancillary industries?
We had
as well.
Enormous excess capacity to build cars in North America. It simply moved jobs from south of the Mason-Dixon line to north. 40,000 jobs, I demonstrated in my book. if we would allow GM to go to bankruptcy court, they had massive assets. They could have been reorganized in the normal way. They would have shut down many of their plants. They would have been down to one or two brands, the only ones that are viable, Cadillac and Chevy. And there would have been more cars produced in the South at roughly $40 an hour or $70,000 a year, and fewer jobs cars produced in Michigan at $60 an hour or $100,000 a year.
So the pain that would have been inflicted on those northern economies would have been, what, short-lived?
No, the pain would have been severe, but the UAW asked for it by driving wages up to $100,000 a year. How many people in America would give their who are unemployed today would give their eye teeth for a $60,000 a year job, which is what you have in the South, and these big plants that have been put up by Hyundai or Honda or Nissan or Toyota, they would gladly have those jobs. And those jobs were never materialized because the government weighed into the scale and propped up some old plants in the North. So the point is the pain happened in the South in the jobs that weren't created because the plants that were failing and the companies that were failing in the North got an unfair, massive $80 billion subsidy from the taxpayers. It didn't do the taxpayers any good. It was just a fight over which state the jobs are going to be in.
I'll leave that argument.
Okay.
These seem easy arguments to say that regulators have been captured, the government has been captured. We see it play out every day in laws that seem reasonable to many people in polls but don't pass. But that seems to be what has happened. You've argued for a number of changes that seem logical and simple, but I want you to tell me, what is your safety net?
I think the main function that government in these times needs to focus on is maintaining the safety net, and that's where the dollars go first. That includes the earned income tax credit, food stamps, Medicaid, and so forth. I think it would be better to consolidate all that into one cash benefit system so that people could get their standard of living supplemented based on some kind of means test if they could prove either A, they couldn't work, or B, that they were working but only making the minimum wage and couldn't support their family. We should put our money in the safety net for people who need it, not into Social Security for retired affluent people who have plenty of assets and other sources of income. And today, we basically spend five times more on social insurance, which isn't means tested, and a lot of it leaks out to people that don't need it, Medicare and Social Security. And we scrimp, and the Republicans want to cut deeply this much smaller safety net, which is the only thing that millions of people today have to fall back on.
You know, David Stockman, James Sarecki in The New Yorker said that in the end, the great deformation, the corruption of capitalism in America was not an economic argument, but a moral argument. Is he right? Are you making a moral argument?
Well, that was his judgment. But yes, there has to be a certain morality behind the conduct of public policy on economics. And I think it's supremely immoral to say, we'll kick the can, we'll get the deficit fixed in 2029, but for today, we'll borrow another trillion in order to prop up a failing economy. That is putting $1 trillion a year, year after year, on the next generation, and they don't even have a vote. Some of them aren't even born. I mean, the biggest evil to the unborn in America today is the unborn taxpayer who's going to be stuck with all of this massive borrowing that this generation has done to prop up its economy. Keynesian economics doesn't work. That's been proved over and over. It's simply borrowing money from the future in order to live a little better today.
I'm going to leave the Keynesian argument out of this because,
okay,
you know, the Keynesians would debate you ad infinitum.
They would.
And perhaps we could make money off of that. David Stockman's book is The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Sometimes breaking news leads to confusion across the media landscape, and nowadays, misinformation can spread worldwide in a matter of moments. How should we cope with this flood of information and misinformation? We'll take that up in a minute.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest public media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
52 degrees in Seattle, working our way up to 60 this afternoon. Forecast calls for sun all day. Overnight, clear, starry sky, and then more sun tomorrow, Tuesday, with a high of 64.
Support for KUOW comes from Consolidated Press, serving Seattle since 1934, offering full-color web, sheet-fed digital printing, binding, and mailing services. 206-447-9659 or on the web at consolidatedpress.com.
Join KUOW for a live broadcast of Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion on Saturday, June 15th at Chateau San Michel Winery in Woodinville. Learn more and find ticket information on the events page at KUOW.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:40. It's been decided that the surviving suspect in the Boston bombing will not be treated as an enemy combatant, but will be prosecuted through our civilian system of justice. We'll have more about that in the news at 11.
A news story that just broke. Do we know it's true? Well, probably was vetted by a few sources. Not the same as what happened over last week's unfolding of the Boston Marathon bombings. What worked and what didn't work, and what do we learn? Monica Guzman writing in the New York Times, in Seattle Times, though who knows, in the Seattle Times wrote, "We're all journalists now. So if we are all journalists, what's our responsibility?" Corey Bergman is general manager of Breaking News, a social media real-time reporting stream owned by NBC News. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Kathy Best is managing editor for content creation at the Seattle Times. She's been a reporter and editor for more than 30 years. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Kathy Gill teaches in the digital media program at the University of Washington's Department of Communication. Thank you.
Thank you.
So just to get a sense of how your life was, what did you do as this story was unfolding last week?
Well, at the very end, I listened to the police scanner on Ustream and I watched Twitter.
And when did the police scanner start actually informing you of what was happening? The whole time?
Well, no. I mean, the police scanner started. I don't know when it actually started, but I started watching it in the last hour on Friday when the suspect was in the boat.
In the boat. And they were the boat story was unfolding.
Yes.
At that point, did we know that the FBI had the or that the authorities had the infrared picture of the man in the boat?
Yes, we did.
All right.
Yeah.
When did you start or how did you follow it, Kathy Best?
Let me count the ways.
Please.
Twitter, the wire services, television, although I made a decision to stop watching CNN very quickly. And those were the three main ways I kept up.
And Corey, what did you do?
Well, I was at home at the time and awake, and our team was monitoring every possible source, and I had Twitter and television up as pretty much maxed my screens out in my living room.
So you were watching television. You did not reject CNN.
No, I mean, what we do is we look across multiple sources and see who's reporting what and then make judgment calls on what we believe is real. So to do that, we need to be looking at different sources and be open to them, although some of them have a better track record than others and those we listen to a little bit more closely.
What helps you determine what is real? How are you making judgments?
Well, for us, we look at three different types of sources. One is news organizations, two is officials, and three are eyewitnesses. And we are able to it is interesting, in the case of the misreported suspects earlier in the week, there was three large news organizations saying there was a suspect in custody and a number of other ones saying we don't know, and then still some others saying our sources are saying no. So at that point, it was less of we have enough sources saying yes, and more of there's just too much dissension, too much noise that we just had to wait a moment. So for us, it's we use the term wait a beat because in maybe 2 minutes, 5 minutes from now, everything could change.
So you did not report the misinformation on your breaking news sites?
No, and we held off on all the premature suspect descriptions as well as a matter of policy for us. Typically in stories like this, the early suspect descriptions are wrong.
How did the Seattle Times handle it on their website where you are updating, but
right,
you don't have to be updating Twitter speed?
Right. We were doing both. We learned a lesson very quickly to stop doing the Twitter updates because there was no payoff and the potential to be wrong and look really stupid was huge. Because we have automated feeds from the AP, we had to, as they say, dance with the one that brung us. It was showing up on our site. So what we were trying to do was put updates at the top saying, this is what AP is reporting. The FBI has not confirmed this. And that was the compromise that we were able to make. But it's very difficult because, when you have automated feeds, you're going to have content coming in. So the best that we could do was monitor what else was going on, including Corey's sites, and try and tell readers, okay, AP's reporting this, but we can't verify this independently. And that's part of the problem when you're a news organization that's 3,000 miles from where the story's unfolding.
Right. So among the egregious examples of misinformation was the reporting by CNN, and then they had to backtrack on it a few times.
Yes.
And John King insisting that he had his sources, his anonymous sources. And in the end, he blamed his anonymous sources for the problem. Yep. If we're all journalists now, what do I have to... How do I glean what's right and what's wrong from CNN, for example?
Well, it's one of the reasons that while we all may be journalists, there is value in having experience as a journalist because there are certain tests that you apply. Who is the source? Does that source have firsthand knowledge? I mean, these are sort of basics of journalism 101, but because I wasn't in the CNN newsroom, I don't know who King's original source was. I don't know how good they were. I don't know who AP's source was. That's part of the problem. You know, anytime you're dealing with breaking news and anonymous sources, we have to trust the reputation and the credibility and the past performance of the news organization.
So here's a little bit of John King, just as a reminder of what he had to say. Do you have that clip of John King? Here's a little bit of what he was saying.
You're getting more information, exclusive reporting. What else are you learning?
That an arrest has been made in the investigation
here
in Boston.
So the suspect that was identified has now been arrested.
We would assume that. I've just been told that an arrest has been made.
Is that why you turned off CNN in part, Abby Gill?
Yes. And let's be clear, CNN was not the first. The first was the New York Post. The New York Post was egregious on Monday, egregious on Tuesday, and egregious on Wednesday, both in their print edition and in their online edition. And they were unapologetic.
They, the Post claimed 12 people were dead at one point. Katie Sewell reminds us they put people's pictures on the front page who were not the suspects, were not even thought to be the suspects. The mainstream media has much to account for in this, yes?
Yes.
Where were you getting, who did you have faith in as you were tracking this story? Twitter and the Boston and the Scanner, but what about
the Boston Globe? So I look at who's on the ground, which is the same thing when we were talking earlier. When you're 3,000 miles away, you want to believe that the people who are physically there have the better in with the story. And so I look to the Globe because they're there. When I was looking at tweets on Friday, I was looking at the tweets of people that were geotagged Watertown, not someone who was geotagged Seattle.
Well, no, I understand that. But why did you assume that because they were, or did you assume because they were geotagged Watertown, they were giving you accurate eyewitness accounts?
When they're showing me the picture of a gunshot in the wall of their house.
So it was image.
And it's a geotag Watertown. I give it more than a 50% chance that, yes, their house has gotten a gunshot in it.
For you too, image matters, Corey Bergman?
Yeah, we have a pretty extensive verification procedure we put through for eyewitness accounts, including that particular picture, which we did post. I remember that very clearly. He had a track record of reporting accurately what he saw, and he was clearly there, and the pictures that he took matched up to some other photos that we saw in the area. So that's the verification that we gave. The interesting phenomenon that I saw the first time in this was there were not only the people who were accidental journalists who just happened to be there and then started reporting, but there were people who were not reporters who actually were were in Boston and then went to the story to become their own journalists. And that to me was something really unique and new, that really was sort of a pack mentality of people wanting to get involved with this huge historic Boston story, so they would show up at the scene and start doing their own reporting. And then you got this echo chamber effect from all these folks that sort of retweeting and passing along each other's information. It became really difficult to tell, really what was real and what was authentic, and not someone who's just really excited about it.
Well, I would not wanted to have been Sunil Tripathi or his friends, who was claimed to be the criminal in this case, and was brought to the fore by Reddit. So crowdsourcing, what were the Reddit showed us the dangers of crowdsourcing, yes, in this, because they were naming people who weren't suspects. They were retweeting information that wasn't retweetable, really. What does it tell you about that aspect, the failure? And then we'll come to the success of crowdsourcing. But what does it tell you about the failure of crowdsourcing?
It shows us that humans do lynch mobs. We always have. The New York Post did a lynch mob and Reddit did a lynch mob. I can't say which lynch mob was the worst. They were both bad. The difference is with the New York Post, it's easier to assign a clear line of blame. There's not a real clear sign of blame when you're talking about an ad hoc formed group at Reddit.
Yeah. The other thing was the fake Twitter account that was created for one of the suspects, which was retweeted a good chunk of time before people realized it was fake. So now let's talk about the positives of this crowdsourcing, because you're mentioning people went there and tried to become their own journalists. Do you find, Kathy Best, in this, that the crowdsourcing is making us all journalists in a positive way?
There were some really interesting and really valuable examples of crowdsourcing, and I wish I could remember the names. I tried to look it up before I got here. There was a guy who was in his apartment who was actually using his computer and aiming it out the window so that people could see what was happening in real time. He wasn't editorializing. He was just describing what he was seeing. That kind of crowdsourcing, talking to people who are on the ground, eyewitnesses, and being able to take advantage of that as an event is happening, it can be very powerful and can help in a very chaotic situation like Thursday night was, can help you figure out a piece of the story, not the whole story.
And again, how did you know that was credible?
Well, because I was watching it, so I was able to see that he was at a place. It would have been very hard, I think, to fake that. Second, some of the sources that were picking up that feed were very credible, and so some of it was trusting the credibility of the organization using it.
That's interesting, isn't it? So We still are looking for a verification, as you all were saying, that we need the verifiers.
Right.
But sometimes the verifiers are the problem.
Right.
So what does media have to do, these verifiers, New York Post, New York Times? You are, of course, relying on these verifiers in part, Corey Bergman, and doing your own verifying.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's an increasing role I think so many news organizations still believe, at least philosophically, that only people that read them are reading only that source of information, that there's no other news source in the world but them. And I think increasingly, obviously everyone is getting news from multiple sources today, some on social media, some not, but I think it becomes increasingly important for a news organization to look and see how others are reacting and then use that as a gauge. If you find someone who's a trusted reporter or trusted news organization, if you're Pete Williams, who has a track record on the federal beat, and you're not going with this story, that could send a message to other news organizations to say, you know what, let's just wait a moment on this. Let's just wait.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about the verification before. What do you think about this, Kathy Gill?
Very similar to Corey's point. And for example, so Danny Sullivan is a reporter who writes about tech stuff and search engine optimization. And he put together a Twitter list of people who were covering the Boston story that he thought were credible. Now, it was traditional sources, the Boston Globe, the New York Times. the police department, the FBI. But you could go look at that Twitter stream and get a feel for what people were saying right now and could see what outliers were.
And you'd have to know that he was somebody trustable and verifiable.
That is true. So you have to know, first you have to know Danny, but anyone, the New York Times could have done that, the Globe could have done that, the Wall Street Journal could have done that, but none of them did because they, I think what Corey said, I'd not thought of it like this, is they don't think about all of those other sources of information that people might be using. Maybe that's the reason that no news organization did that, that it took an outsider to do that.
Oh, I think they created those lists internally, right? They just didn't surface it externally.
Right. Is that right? Did you guys do that at the Times or something like that at the Times, Kathy Best?
We probably did it informally because a lot of what was happening at night. And so I was on my own screen at home. I had like five or six different tabs in Firefox. I was watching Twitter and I had two different TVs on. So I was making my own choices about how to watch information. And one of the reasons that just using one screen is scary for any journalist trying to figure out whether something's true is even news organizations that are credible sometimes have different standards for different platforms. So someone might put something out as a tweet that they would never put on their website, that they might never put on the air. And so you really need to watch very carefully and watch multiple sources and multiple platforms.
What does that tell us about what Twitter's responsibility is? I don't mean the company, but those of us using it.
Mm-hmm.
Is there another standard here that we want to assign to those who tweet, which is you gotta, if it's good enough for Twitter, it has to be good enough for your newspaper or your broadcast outlet?
We have those standards internally, but you can create policies. Getting reporters, especially reporters in the heat of the moment when their adrenaline is flowing and you know their competitive juices are flowing, to remember those standards. You don't edit Twitter in advance. If somebody's out on the street, it doesn't go back to an editor before it goes out. It goes into the stream.
By the way, on that notion of adrenaline, On the Media, the NPR show, which takes a look at what the media does, On Media producer Alex Goldman was among those tweeters Thursday night. He was live tweeting. He was listening to the police scanner as police were chasing down the suspect. And the host, Brooke Gladstone, asked him what was drawing him to tweet this breaking news.
As much as I hate to admit this, and I'm almost scared that this is going to end up on the air, there really is a thrill to being the first, or being as close to the first as possible to report a story. And I don't think that there's anybody who reports news that doesn't fall prey to that. And there is a real immediacy and sort of a stimulus response to tweeting. It's like pushing the bar to get a pellet. It's very seductive.
All right, so it's seductive. We are all journalists now. You mentioned Pete Williams at NBC. Seems to come out of this much cleaner than many another broadcast journalist because he took a moment or two each time before he shared his information. So how does that help me as the roving journalist wandering this planet?
Well, I think it's a good lesson for journalists. I'm actually increasingly more concerned about how there's a new pack of people who aren't journalists who still have that thrill of being first. And the fact that 250,000 people were listening live to that police scanner and then sending out information as if they were there makes it much more difficult. And the media just has to be obviously more careful about what they assume is true, even though it has a track record of being true, because it could just be a guy tweeting a scanner in his apartment somewhere in Chicago.
You know, I want to ask about, just as a final question, the book I interviewed an hour or so earlier was How Media Shapes History. And the author's argument was that in part radio, very powerful, very seductive, because it's cheap, it sits on your shoulder. And he said the iconic image of that power was a Rwandan with a machete in one hand and a boombox in the other. Is it dangerously possible that our smartphones and our Twitter feeds replace that boombox?
Oh, they have. I don't think I would call it dangerous, But
I'm taking to the dangerous part. I mean, that's what I'm asking. Can we whip up a crowd to and a frenzy too? We do have a, you know.
Can we? We've always been able to whip up a crowd with a frenzy with media.
Well, we got the whole world. We can do it with the whole world now.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing new with that. Speakers have been able to do that. Revival tents. I mean, always. But there's certainly a democratization here. Anybody can do it. So you could say there's equally leveling of the ground, so to speak.
A leveling of the panic and the, the demagogues.
Yeah, you don't have to buy your ink by the barrel
anymore.
See.
So we're not just all journalists now. We could all be demagogues now. That's one thing to learn.
Well, that's, I guess, I didn't say that.
No, I'm saying that. I'm giving you my conclusion from what I learned. There's a lot of good information, but we have to be careful. I guess we know that all the time. Kathy Gill teaches in the digital media program at the UW. Kathy Best is a managing editor at the Seattle Times. And Corey Bergman helps run BreakingNews.com. I thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll continue this story tomorrow, and we'll try not to be demagogues and give you good information. This is Weekday.
A national and international news update from NPR in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Kirkland Choral Society, presenting Songs of America with the Rich.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.